Well, welcome to ForTruth.net. I have the privilege again of interviewing a dear friend of mine, someone who has become a dear friend over the last several years. His name is Dr. Craig Keener. He is a New Testament professor, an esteemed scholar, has written just huge commentaries, great books. And welcome back, Craig. It's great to be with you again.
It's great to be with you, Mike.
You know, your Historical Jesus of the Gospels book was just an amazing book. It really was. Huge book of over 800 pages. And I just found so much in that book to be helpful. I loved it. The book, however, did not treat miracles. And miracles were a big part of what the Gospels reported about Jesus' ministry.
It's true.
Things like even his resurrection, the biggest miracle of all. So miracles are not treated in the Historical Jesus of the Gospels book.
I know somebody who wrote a really good book on the historiography of the resurrection.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll interview him someday.
Namely Mike Lacona.
We'll get, Gary Habermas here someday. Why didn't your book treat miracles?
Well, the issues would have taken me too far afield. The Historical Jesus of the Gospels worked mainly from consensus methodology, which is harder to do with miracles where there's not so much consensus. And also, I had too much material to really fit in. Miracles started expanding and expanding and expanding. I couldn't get it in the Historical Jesus book.
Wow. Well, your new book, you have a new book coming out next year. This is 2010. This is Sunday, so this is the week of Thanksgiving, 2010. And they're estimating around this time next year, your book on miracles will come out with Baker, right?
Yes. Miracles, the Credibility of the New Testament Accounts.
Great. And that's a pretty large book, isn't it?
It should be over 1,000 pages. It will be longer than the Historical Jesus book.
Well... That's a long book, and you got the Historical Jesus book. I mean, you're known now to be a scholar who produces very large books.
Sorry about that, but you need something to prop the door. And it was originally going to be with a different publisher, but they sold their academic division, and so now it's with Baker Academic, and I'm very pleased to be with...
That was going to be Hendrickson, right?
I mean,
that's a good publisher.
Yeah.
And so is Baker Academic. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
And we talk about long books. And the other day when there was a session here at the Evangelical Theological Society and they were discussing a panel to discuss your book, they introduced you and they were talking about how lengthy your books are. I mean, your John commentary is just shy of 1,700 pages, right?
I think it's 1,600 something, but you're including the index there.
I'll tell you, what I loved about that book was the introductory information especially. It was it's worth the price of the commentary itself, which is, you know, fairly pricey, but definitely worth its weight. I mean, it's just great stuff. And then you're doing an Acts commentary, which is, if I remember correctly, over 7,000 pages long?
Yeah, in manuscript form. I'm sure that they will find a way in typesetting to make it a bit shorter.
So we should get some reading glasses.
Probably. And I'm sorry about the price of the books. I would price them less, but of course the publishers say you want them to be less, write shorter books, and they have a point. So,
well, if you're Acts commentary, I'm sure I can't wait to read the stuff about historiography and antiquity that I'm sure you did in the introductory information or portion of the book that talks about the speeches in Acts and Luke is the historian and the style. That stuff is just going to be gold. I can't wait to read that. You just have such a wealth of information. You just blow my mind. I remember back when I wanted to meet you because I'd purchased your commentary on John and was reading through it. And gosh, this guy is just amazing. The breadth and depth of information he knows is just mind-boggling. And I remember sitting with you at dinner. It was you. It was Sean McDowell.
Uh-huh.
It was a friend of mine named Cindy Peters and myself. And the four of us were eating dinner. And we were all just in awe of your scholarship. And then I said, Craig, you must have been a real nerd, a recluse when you were a child, I'll bet. And I'll bet you were reading Homer at 12. And you said something like, I think it was around 12 that was amazing.
Yeah, Homer and Tacitus around 12, Plato around 13, and so on. But I was reading them in English translation, so don't blow it up too big.
Well, I'm feeling much better then, because if you were telling me you were reading Tacitus and Latin, none of us really going to feel badly because I was still playing dodgeball at age 12 when you were reading all the classics.
They don't let nerds play dodgeball.
Yes, they did. That's why I was playing it. So this next book on miracles, you said it's going to be probably over 1,000 page long.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Depending, I don't know what the typesetting will be, but it's significantly longer than the historical Jesus book.
Significantly. Well, that one's over 800 pages. Yeah. It's amazing. It's got to be my favorite book on the historical Jesus out there.
Oh, thank you.
I love it. It's just, you were just so careful, and I love your emphasis on historical method and going back and understanding the genre of the Gospels and what they were doing. It makes so much sense in the work that you and Richard Burridge have done on this is, you've paved the way. You've done some really groundbreaking material, and we are all of us in New Testament are indebted to you. You like to do careful research. You document your books. How many sources did you cite in this miracles book that's coming out next year?
I believe it's somewhere over 4,000 different works, not including ancient sources. So if you wonder why I'm tired. But some of those works are cited only once and peripherally. Others are interacted with in more detail.
Why do many scholars today take for granted that miracles do not occur? I was in a debate with Stephen Patterson of the Jesus Seminar this past March. It was at Florida State University. Fine debate. I mean, we talked beforehand. I consider Stephen to be a friend of mine. We got along just fine. We had a wonderful collegial debate. But during the course of the debate, he said, okay, Mike's talking about resurrection of Jesus, but I just don't see these things happen today. I don't see miracles occur. And this seems to be a position that is largely embraced by mainstream scholarship. Why do you think that is?
Before I answer, would you like to finish that story? I've heard this story from you before.
Well, I got up in my rebuttal and I said, well, you know, Steve says he doesn't see these things happening today. And I said, you know, Steve, maybe that's because you're casting your net to get samplings from your own life and those of other friends of yours who belong to a skeptical subculture. But if you cast your net into the sea of human experience, then miracle claims start to pop up everywhere. I said, let me just give you one. A guy, a friend of mine who, the director of collegiate ministries for the Florida Baptist Convention. And I said, his name's Loy Reed. I said, back in June of 1987, he was involved in a horrible car accident and it put him in a coma for 21 days. Well, 4th of July of 1987 was the 21st day of that coma. And his church had gone out to a church picnic to a park that day or somewhere like that. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they all got together to pray for Loy. And a remarkable thing happened at 4 o'clock in the hospital. Loy came out of his coma. So he didn't even know they were praying for him. He came out of his coma, but it doesn't stop there. Craig, there were a number of other people, patients in the same room as Loy, who had all been in a coma from 1 to 6 months. And every last one of them came out of their coma by the end of that night.
Awesome.
I ended with that rebuttal and I said, and it just so happens, this is really interesting. I know this is Florida, but I didn't even think about it being Loy's state. And he came up to me probably 5 minutes before the debate started and just said, hey, Mike, just want to let you know I'm here. Came out to see you. And so Loy is here this evening. Loy, would you stand up and wave? And he waved and 950 people, the estimated audience members, turned around and looked at Loy, and there he was. And I said, you know, Steve, I don't know how you argue with that, but miracles do occur today. And if they occur today, that increases the plausibility that they occurred in the past. So,
yes.
Yeah, you have a lot of scholars saying that this doesn't happen today, but it does happen today. I mean, that's just one of several examples I could give you. And I'm sure with your book and everything you've done here, you've got just tons of examples.
Yes. Yes, but you see, you don't need to interview me. You could interview yourself and do just fine. But there's so much like this. But you asked why many scholars today take for granted that miracles don't occur. You know, we're in an information age, but it's not just information. It's also the framework in which we interpret it that matters. And while we've continued to accumulate information, the grids through which we frame the information are often simply inherited from our culture or from an earlier stage of our culture, if we assume that miracles can't happen, even evidence for miracles gets explained away as something else. Let me give you an example of that. My friend Bill Heth teaches at Taylor University, and he was present at a prayer meeting. He's the one who told me about this. He was present at a prayer meeting when a student of his who had a severe eye problem and had to wear special glasses and so on for this severe eye problem, there was another student praying for her and just was feeling what the Holy Spirit was doing as this student was being miraculously healed. You know, the student went back to the eye doctor.
No, wait a minute. So the student that was praying for this girl.
Yes.
Was the student praying for the girl at a distance or right there?
She was right there.
Okay. But this was at a meeting or something one night?
Yeah, a prayer meeting.
Okay.
But the student who was being healed was feeling these things at the same time that this other person was praying for these things. The person who was being healed, she went back to her doctor. She no longer needs the glasses. There was actual physical change in her. The doctor, out of 7,000 cases, had never seen anything like this. But the doctor wouldn't call it a miracle because miracles don't happen, although she didn't have another explanation for it. So it is important, you know, the grids through which we interpret the evidence.
So what was the thing? She had bad eyesight. She had to wear special glasses.
Yeah. Her condition was vertical heteroporia, which also caused migraine headaches because her eyes weren't exactly aligned, and so it was hard for the brain to process the information. But
and the headaches went away?
The headaches, yeah, everything. And she sent me medical documentation for
and she never has had to wear glasses again?
No, she doesn't have to wear glasses. She can drive without them.
And you've got medical documentation for this?
In this case, what I have is her former condition and also the fact that she no longer needs to wear glasses.
Doesn't get any better than that, I guess.
Yeah, that's pretty good. But many today simply assume that miracles don't happen. They assume it's a settled issue without knowing where they got it. Some others know that their view ultimately goes back to David Hume, but they regard it as settled without realizing that Hume's essay about miracles has always been debated.
Tell me a little about David Hume. Now, he's the 17th or the 18th century Scottish skeptic, wrote a very influential essay called Of Miracles. Been very influential, even up to the present day. And yes, it's always been debated. In fact, I remember, I think it was Gary Habermas and Doug Guyvet who wrote a book in defense of miracles back in the late 1990s that Anthony Flew, who was an atheist at the time and a Humean scholar and had taught at some of the most prestigious universities in the world, said that this was the book to answer. There's a lot of refutations of Hume in there.
Yes.
So let's just talk about Hume's essay. Why have his arguments been so influential during the past 2.5 centuries?
I don't think it's so much because of the content as just because of him being Hume. Hume's essay mostly recycles earlier arguments raised by deists, often without giving their full argument. So sometimes you can't even understand exactly what his concise argument is about unless you go back and read his predecessors. But in his day, there was a writer named Conyers Middleton who argued against miracles, carefully avoiding the issue of biblical miracles. That was far more influential in his day than Hume's essay. This is one of the most logically problematic of Hume's essays, but it was his prestige that eventually made his essay the influential one.
His prestige? Are you saying that people respected Hume prior to this much more than they did Conyers?
No, I'm saying eventually Hume's prestige, his reputation because of his other philosophic work, overshadowed the others.
So you say that this essay was logically problematic. What were some of the problems with it?
There are a number of them, but just to summarize, in the first part of his essay, one of the issues is uniform natural law, which assumes a uniform law extrapolated from human experience and then excludes all testimony for miracles from that supposed uniform experience. He also speaks of miracles as violating or transgressing natural law, as if the God who established such natural law would be subject to it, which is something quite contrary to what most of the early English Enlightenment thinkers would have said. His language of violating or transgressing, that's deliberately provocative, because no theist actually, I mean, today we've adopted his language often, but no theist would have ever agreed to those terms, and the theists in his day didn't agree to his terms.
I don't understand why many skeptics today find that kind of an argument persuasive, that God can't violate or transgress his own law as though it's a sin to do so. Like you said, if God set up this, he can do it whatever he wants. It's as though they're trying to limit the God in which they don't believe.
make
up their own rules here.
It's making up their own rules because it's not addressing the theist's argument. It's just bypassing them rhetorically. Basically, it's asking theists to give up their theism without the courtesy of telling them that's what they have to do. But today, most people treat natural law, if they use the language, is merely descriptive, and there's no view of natural law today. There's several views of natural law today, but none of them fit Hume's understanding of natural law. His perspective on this contrasts with the early Enlightenment, including John Locke, who affirmed miracles in the Bible, and it also contrasts with the early English scientists of his day. Robert Boyle, sometimes called the father of chemistry, was an evangelical apologist for Christianity as well. Isaac Newton was Arian. We wouldn't consider him fully orthodox in the Trinitarian sense, but he argued from design, and he also argued for miracles. And his Newtonian followers continued to believe in miracles for quite some time after Hume. But the most fundamental problem with Hume's argument is that it's basically circular. He speaks of uniform human experience and uses that against even a significant number of independent witnesses. He goes out of his way to explain why we can't trust such witnesses, and ultimately it comes down to the fact that we can't trust them because their claims violate uniform human experience. And even in his day, his own day, there were a lot of people's claimed experiences that didn't fit his grid. There's so many today, he couldn't really get away with that argument about uniform human experience. It's simply not uniform.
That reminds me of a funny little story. It's fake, but it really illustrates the point well. I'm sure you've heard him plenty of times where guy thinks he's dead.
Yes.
And his wife says, look, you're not dead, you're alive. I'm experiencing you, and why don't you go see the doctor? Maybe the doctor can convince you. So he goes to see the family physician, and he tells the physician, I think I'm pretty convinced I'm dead. And the physician says, well, tries all these things, and the guy just won't believe him. So, I can hear your heartbeat and all this stuff. Finally says, can we agree that dead people don't bleed? And the guy thought for a moment and says, yeah, we can agree on that. And so the doctor pricked him with a needle, and the guy bled. And he said, see, you're alive. And the guy said, well, how about that? I guess dead people do bleed. So it's like there was no amount of evidence whatsoever that could convince this guy, because you get the evidence, you would just expand your burden of proof to rule that out. And so that's just weighing in with your bias. It's not weighing in with the evidence.
Precisely.
And it seems like that's what Hume was doing, isn't it? I mean, if something would come up, you just say, well, that can't be real.
Yeah, or at least you can't know it's real. Hume has fixed the rules of the argument so that he can't possibly be contradicted unless somebody notices that he's just fixed the rules.
So tell me, what did you think of it today? You had an exchange with Robert Miller of the Jesus Seminar. So there was a panel discussion that was assessing your book and assessing the book co-authored by Daryl Bach or co-edited by Daryl Bach and Bob Webb on the historical Jesus. And Robert Miller said, we don't see these things happening today. And you said, well, on the contrary, we do. And I document a bunch of these in the Miracles book. I don't recall, but it seemed like he really didn't have a response for that.
Actually, I think we ended up not completely disagreeing on the issue that we do see things like that today. So I wasn't sure.
It might not be the stark contrast that started to paint there.
After I said we do see things like this today, we may not all interpret them the same way, but things like this are attested all around the world.
Okay, I got you.
He said if I understood him right, he said yes. But again, I don't want to speak for him because, like you said at the beginning of the session, somebody from the Jesus Seminar hearing the session and somebody from our side that would be have a higher view of Scripture or a higher view of the historical reliability of the Gospels would come to different conclusions about how the session went based on our different presuppositions.
Sure.
But it did seem to me that he really didn't contradict what I said about that, that these things are documented around the world.
Many supporting arguments there are that you have for miracles that would go against the Humean argument that says the uniform testimony of history is that these things don't happen today.
Yeah, Hume offers different supporting arguments. I mean, he dismisses ancient testimony, saying it's not happening today. He dismisses other cultures, calling them ignorant and barbarous nations. Ultimately, when he speaks of uniform human experience, it comes down to his own circle's experience. It's kind of a limited, constricted pool of information.
So what do you think he would do with someone, or Hume, or someone who follows Hume today? What do you think that they would do with someone like Dale Allison? How would they deal with something like Allison's experiences of these apparitions of the dead that Allison argues are many of them are corroborated? You've got good evidence that there's some kind of a paranormal thing that is going on here. How would someone like Hume respond? What I'm saying about Allison is he's not an evangelical Christian by any stretch of the imagination. And yet he talks about these supernatural things that are occurring. Says that, you know, we've got many documented cases. You just can't dismiss these as hallucinations or wishful thinking or something. I mean, that would be out of Hume's, the net of experiences that he has, wouldn't you say?
Hume might, I don't know, he might say they're subjective, or he might just, if it's something that's objective, there actually were things that were multiply attested, independent witnesses attesting healings, and he just didn't accept them because he said miracles can't happen.
I guess the thing I'm trying to say with the Allison thing is when Hume says that these really only happen with barbarous people, you know, here we think of third world people running around naked down in the Amazon, or, you know, it's not just barbarians or the uneducated who are claiming that there are miracles that have happened in the world. There are very highly educated people like yourself,
yes,
who can testify to miracles, like Loy Reed, the guy I mentioned down in Florida, who can testify to it. I mean, I can tell you of an experience I had several years ago. I was asked to come in and be the speaker for a weekend retreat for senior high students for a very liberal denomination, moderate to liberal. But at this one, just to give you an idea, the worship leader was a lesbian atheist. So this was by no means a gathering of conservative Christians or evangelical Christians. Right before I went up and spoke on Friday night, a youth leader that came up to me and said, "Hey, Mike," pointed me in the direction of the hallway, and there was a girl out there weeping, and said, "Do you see her?" I said, "Yeah." Said she just received news from her dad that her grandfather, who had open heart surgery today, is probably not going to make it, and he's in bad condition. "Would you mind, before you speak, while the singing's still going on, just going up and praying with her?" And I said, "Sure." So I went up to her and told her that, you know, my grandfather, I'd been very close to him, and I understand, and let's just pray for him. And so we did. Well, the next day, I saw her about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and she was walking with, I think, three or four guys. Let's just say three guys. And we're walking through this big field, ball field, between some buildings, and our paths were going in the opposite directions, and we passed each other, and I said to the girl, "Hey, have you heard anything about your grandfather?" And she said, "Well, my dad called me just a little while ago, said his condition is definitely going south, and he could die at any moment. They expect him to die at any moment." And I said, "Well, let's pray for him." They all just kind of looked at me and said, "What, here? Now?" And I said, "Yeah." And so let's just sit down here on the ball field and each of us pray for him one by one. And so they did with hesitation. You know, it's like when you hear their prayers, they either are not used to praying in front of others, or they don't really pray at all. But each of us prayed for her grandfather. We asked that God would heal him. Well, probably 2 hours later, she comes running up to me, Mr. Mike, I've been looking all around for you. And I said, well, what's up? And she said, well, my grandfather just called me. And he said, were you praying for me around 2 o'clock this afternoon? She said, yeah, a bunch of us were. He said, it was really weird. I was really feeling horrible. And around 2 o'clock, I felt something happen in my body. And I guess I've been healed. I'm going to make it. I'm feeling strong. They told me I'm going to be just fine. Well, this word went throughout the whole camp now. And now all, I mean, this is the talk of the youth leaders, of the students. It was cool. It was like God acted here. A bunch of people then came up and said, hey, would you pray for me? You know, I'm nothing special. You can pray too. It's the same God. I'm not healing here. It's God who's doing the healing. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people that I prayed for, they got their prayers answered, some of them immediately. It was just an amazing situation. And, you know, it gets me thinking about too, is just as a little side note, I've prayed for others. I'm not thinking I've got the gift of healing or anything like that, but I've prayed for others and, you know, they haven't been healed. Mm-hmm. I prayed for others and they have been. I mean, I had a girlfriend once before I met my wife, and let's just say it was 9 o'clock at night and she was getting ready to get in her car to go home. She said, hey, would you pray for my dad or my mom? She's been sick and really feeling horrible. I said, sure. So we prayed for her right there. And she got home, wasn't thinking anything about it, walked in the door. Hey, mom, how you doing? Just kind of a typical thing you'd say. How are you feeling? And she says, something, because right around 9 o'clock, I felt something happen in my body. And I feel fine right now. The fever's left. I feel great. And I wonder sometimes if these things happen, Craig. You know, sometimes we don't get healed. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we get our prayers answered. Sometimes we don't. And I wondered if things like this and others are because it's a situation where God can work and reveal his power to non-believers. So it's not to be like a cosmic Santa Claus to help us on a wish list, but he's doing it sometimes out of compassion for us, but mainly to show his glory and power in a situation where others may come to know him. What do you think about that?
Yeah, many times it's on the cutting edge of evangelism, and we can multiply examples like this, not just with evangelism, but thinking back to your stories. There was a time when a colleague and I prayed for one of the presenters at SBL who wasn't going to be able to present his session the next day. He was going to have to go home because he was really sick. We prayed for him. And I didn't bother going to the session because I knew he was really sick. My colleague went, and sure enough, he was there. He said, yeah, I got healed when you prayed for me. It's a little faith I had. But when I was an undergraduate, there was a seminarian. He was part of the nursing home Bible study that I was also involved in. And there was this lady, Barbara, who had been unable to walk ever since I'd known her. She was always sitting in her wheelchair and saying, I wish I could walk. And one day, the seminarian walked across the room, picked her up by the hand, said, in the name of Jesus, rise up and walk. And I stared in horror. I was afraid Barbara would fall on the ground. I don't recommend people just do this, because if it's not the Lord, you know, and she had horror on her face. I mean, this was not our faith by any means, but he walked her around the room. I mean, she used a walker for security for a while after that, but she could walk. And after a while, she just dispensed with the walker altogether.
Well, that's remarkable.
She
How
never
long has she
again,
been in that wheelchair?
There's no way I could know that. But ever since I'd known her, she'd been in that wheelchair.
How long had you known her?
For several months.
Wow.
And
did you ever ask that seminary student what made you or led you to go up and say that to her? Had he ever done that with anyone else?
I don't think he did that on a normal basis. I think he just felt at that moment he was supposed to do that.
Well, that's interesting. So, okay, so you know these stories. I'm familiar with stories. Other of these stories pop up all around. So in light of all of these stories, and these are modern-day examples. They're intelligent people. I mean, you've got your PhD from Duke. They're from intelligent people are aware of these things. So how could Hume assume that his experience was comprehensive enough to rule out other people's claims of experience?
You know, at this point, I don't think that Hume was actually consistent with his own epistemology, his own approach to knowledge, but I'll leave that to philosophers to discuss. But I think one example illustrates pretty well the problem. It was an example that was actually bantered back and forth in Hume's era and subsequently, and that's the example that some gave of a prince in a faraway land to whom Dutch visitors reported rivers that became so hard during winter that people could ride across them on horses. And the prince dismissed this as simply impossible. Hume's response was, well, the prince was right. Based on his experience and his knowledge, he was right to say that you can't ride horses across a river. And of course, the point of Hume's detractors was, no, the prince was wrong because he wasn't willing to accept other people's testimony of their experience, which happened to be correct. And Hume, in this case, turns out to be like that prince. And miracles, in this analogy, are like the frozen rivers. Hume refused to accept evidence that in fact, could be very compelling. And some of that evidence existed in his own day.
So it's almost like, by the methodology, the principles by which Hume was operating, they actually would lead him to mistaken conclusions about history.
Yes.
And he would have to acknowledge that. When people would point out, hey, Hume, if you go by your methodology that you're articulating, that you're being very stubborn about, in many cases, as we can point out here with the frozen river, it's going to lead you to a mistaken view of history if you were that prince.
Yes.
But if you open yourself up to the testimony of others, yes, it may take you to issues outside of your personal horizon of your own knowledge and experience, but it can lead you to a more accurate view of the world.
Yes. He acknowledges that there are sometimes unusual circumstances, but he says miracles, he would view miracles as not merely unusual, but against uniform human experience, against natural law. But of course, that just begs the question. I mean, if you don't a priori exclude the possibility of a theistic explanation, you don't have to a priori exclude the possibility of miracles.
Wow. This is an epiphany for me. This is good. I think this could have been used in your panel discussion today, because when Robert Miller was saying, you know, we all have these different horizons here and how do you adjudicate between them? Or was it Amy Jill Levine? One of them, they were saying, okay, you know, you've got these different horizons. Some may believe that God acts in the world. Some may say, no, he doesn't. And so you're going to have conservative scholars who are going to do their sort of historical Jesus studies. You're going to have your more liberal scholars, those on the left, do their historical Jesus scholars, and they're not going to be able to interact because they're coming operating within two different kinds of grids. And so this example from David Hume, talking about the prince with the frozen river, the hard river that you could walk across, this would have, I think, worked well to say, hey, we have to be, and I'm not just saying those on the left, those of us on the right, of course, always have to be too. It's not just the other guy, but everybody has to be open to expanding our horizon. We can't just operate within the grid of our horizon. Just like any historical conclusion, we hold it as provisional. It could be otherwise. And I think that as staunch as you may be as a Christian, or as staunch as someone like Richard Dawkins may be as an atheist and convinced that God does not exist, you have to hold that provisionally and say it could be otherwise. In fact, something like a well-attested miracle would be just all that would be needed, just one well-attested miracle to show that that horizon is mistaken.
That's true, but then some people, and I think Hume would do this, place the bar of attestation so high, even if you've got lots of witnesses, presumably even if you have medical documentation, he might say it's forged because, hey, we know these things don't happen. It's really a circular argument.
Yeah, and there you just show a stubborn skepticism and a hard heart that is unwilling to go where the evidence leads. You're weighing in with your bias. You're not weighing in with the evidence. Okay, well then you mentioned that experiences back then didn't fit his grid, his horizon. You talked about this prince and that was in the frozen river that was discussed. Anything else you have in mind?
Well, yeah, there were some concrete examples of reports of healing that were available to Hume in his own day, and he acknowledged the evidence for them and simply used that as a way of saying, well, you see, even things that obviously didn't happen, people can give good evidence for. So, you know, he uses it in a very skeptical way. One of the claims that he raises, it's the healing of actually Pascal's niece. Now, Pascal was a pretty smart guy. Some have called him the father of the modern computer. And it convinced Pascal. But his niece had an organic, long-term running sore on her eye that was healed immediately in a context of prayer. There were many witnesses. The Queen of France sent her own physician to examine the woman, and the physician was convinced. Yet Hume dismisses it because he says simply, miracles don't happen. And he got away with it because his readers didn't like the Jansenists, which, you know, she and Pascal were Jansenists. His readers didn't like Jansenists anyway, so he could get away with the argument.
What's a Jansenist?
The Jansenists were an Augustinian Catholic sect that were a bit too Protestant for the Catholics and a bit too Catholic for the Protestants. So everybody could dump on him, you know, but there were miracles that took place there, claimed miracles, and some of them, like this one, I think the evidence is very strong.
So we see these things Pascal's day and Hume's day. Any examples in earlier history?
There are many, but I should pause to note one point for the hearers. Some believers expect miracles today as in the first century, and some don't. But most people, I think, will allow that God can still sovereignly do anything, and he often answers our prayers as in, for example, James chapter 5. For the point at hand, it doesn't matter which view one holds. I think all of us agree in practice that not everybody gets healed, otherwise we'd be immortal. But it only takes a very few extraordinary cases to make the point. So going back to your direct question about examples in earlier history, many church fathers offered their eyewitness claims of healings and even raisings from the dead. Augustine is a good example of this. He had originally believed that miracles ceased in the days of the original apostles. But then he had some eyewitness experience with it. He himself was healed of something, but a more dramatic example he cites is a friend of his named Innocent, who had anal abscesses, had been through one surgery, but was told he was going to have another one because there was something still there that was very painful, and yet they didn't have anesthesia. People often bled to death during surgery or died of shock. So the night before the surgery, you know, he still had this problem. They'd seen it, and he was just crying out in anguish to God. And Augustine said to himself, God, if anything can move you, surely this man's anguished cries can move you. The next morning, as the doctors went in to operate, they removed the bandage that they put on the day before. It was gone. And Augustine was there, and he was an eyewitness. In 2 years, his church collected affidavits for 70 healings, and he said that there were more, some that people just hadn't got around to reporting, providing affidavits for. He included raisings from the dead among the things. In the Reformation period, and of course there were many things happening in the Middle Ages too, but in the Reformation period there was a reaction against the abuses that were taking place because of relics and so on. And yet, when it came to a need to pray, it said that Luther prayed for Melanchthon on his deathbed, and Melanchthon recovered and attributed that to Luther's prayer for him. And coming after Hume's time, during the Wesleyan revival, Wesley himself actually argued against Hume's approach, but during the Wesleyan revival, they report some healings, the healing of a blind eye. Wesley prayed for somebody whom they believed was dead. He prayed for him, and the man revived. Wesley reports in his own...
He was dead.
Yeah, according to Wesley's journal, that's what they thought. And Wesley himself, in his journal, reports being healed in answer to prayer. The late 19th century, there actually was an interdenominational, transcontinental movement that was emphasizing healing among evangelicals, many evangelicals. A.J. Gordon, you've heard of Gordon Conwell Seminary or Gordon College, they're named for him. He was one of the leaders in that. A.B. Simpson, the founder of Christian and Missionary Alliance, and others. Some people became too extreme with it, and others reacted against them, but the movement itself was most of them regained a moderate middle position, saying, okay, God doesn't always heal, but we can believe that God can do miracles today.
You'd mentioned earlier that Hume dismissed other cultures as being ignorant and barbarous. Why was he so strong against them?
Keep in mind, I'm about to quote something that Hume said. If this sounds offensive to you, it really sounds offensive to me. My wife is from Congo in Africa. I don't take kindly to language like this. But anyway.
You're definitely white.
Yes.
She's definitely black.
Yes. Hume says, quote, I am apt to suspect the Negroes and in general all of the other species of men, for there are four or five different kinds, to be naturally inferior to the whites. There never was a civilized nation of any other complexion than white. He also said that none of the slaves, out of all the slaves, none of them ever achieved learning. He did acknowledge the argument that there was one Jamaican who could recite poetry, but he said he's just like a parrot. Doesn't take any intelligence of his own to imitate intelligence. Now, this Jamaican to whom he referred was Francis Williams, who was a Cambridge graduate and composed his poetry in Latin.
Oops.
I would consider that pretty smart. Hume's arguments again, in favor of slavery and his arguments in favor of racism made it harder for the abolitionists. They had to contend against him. And he cast a long shadow. There were a lot of people who appealed to Hume's prestige in support of racism as well. So when he dismisses the views of other nations as those of ignorant and barbarous peoples, that comes out of a very ethnocentric perspective. And that should simply be not permitted today. I mean, that should simply be dismissed today from any credibility.
Yeah, and as we know, the world is getting pretty globalized today. A lot different than it was back then. When I was doing my doctoral work, I was talking to my doctoral supervisor who was in South Africa at the time. I was in Atlanta, and we're talking live on Skype. So our world is definitely getting smaller. What happens if we take into account the testimonies from other countries? So Hume, because he was a racist, was unwilling to do that. You had to be white. You had to be Caucasian in order for your testimony even to count. And then someone like Blaise Pascal, you get someone like that, and he still dismisses it.
Right.
So what does he do with the test? What happens today if we take into account testimonies of miracles from other cultures?
Well, it's really significant because majority world voices are really a major part of Christianity today. Only 18% of Christians in 1900 lived outside the West. Today, it's over 60%, and it's estimated that it'll be about 70% by 2025. That's the majority of Christians, majority of evangelicals are outside the West. Justo Gonzalez says that, Bultmann says miracles are impossible, but what Bultmann says is impossible, he says, we see all the time in Latino churches. It especially happens in cutting-edge evangelism in new areas. Healings were a part of the Korean revival in the early 20th century. J.P. Moreland says that up to 70% of evangelical growth around the world in recent decades is, quote, intimately connected to signs and wonders. I'll give you an example from China. The China Christian Council, which is affiliated with the more official recognized church, it reported that half of the conversions in the past 20 years were related to experiences of people either being healed or knowing people who were. One survey of the house churches gives an estimate of 90% instead of 50%. Mm. Whatever the figures are exactly, the central point is that there are many testimonies, and this came up in my interviews with Chinese pastors and pastors around the world. If we take an obvious example of a group that often speaks about healing, this is not China per se specifically, this is just around the world, our Pentecostal and Charismatic brothers and sisters, using a very broad definition, statistical definition that not everybody would follow, but they're estimated at about 500 million people, which means they outnumber mainline Christians. Sociologist Peter Berger says they account for something like 80% of evangelical Protestantism's worldwide growth. And a 2006 Pew Forum survey of just 10 countries, not including China that I mentioned, over 200 million Pentecostals and Charismatics in these 10 countries alone claim to have experienced or witnessed miraculous healing. So you can estimate globally that's maybe 300, 400 million claims. But what I want to point out, something that I think is even more significant, in the same survey, 39% of Christians in these 10 countries who are not Pentecostal or charismatic claim to have experienced or witnessed divine healing. And just for some of the kinds of examples of places where this has happened, I mean, the Reformed Christians in Indonesia in the 1960s reported raisings from the dead, healings of blindness, and so on. You have reports of these kind of things from Presbyterians in Malawi, Baptists in Tanzania and Chile, Mennonites in Ethiopia. And my interviews with people specifically, they're all across the range. I mean, Baptists, Presbyterians, Pentecostals, and many others. I'm not saying that every experience or every claim is necessarily a genuine miracle, but Hume's appeal to uniform human experience at this point is simply irrational. It's simply not uniform.
Wow. Yeah, you're talking millions of claims. How many? I mean, you can see millions
Pew,
of people.
Pew Survey,
are doing
we're
it.
Talking about hundreds of millions of claims.
Hundreds of millions. I mean, how many people would a Hume have known in his day that said these things don't happen? It would pale in comparison.
Yeah, and saying that things don't happen based on your lack of experience of it can be drawing from a small pool. At this point in my life, I can say I've never been to New Zealand, but I'm not going to dispute the existence of New Zealand simply because I don't have direct experience of it.
Sure. Are any of these miracle claims medically documented?
Yes, some of them are. But I should note up front that most areas where people pray for supernatural healing, it's partly because they don't have medical help available.
So it's kind of like God's doing this. There is no medical help, so God helps them out. Here in Western culture, we might have medical help. He doesn't intervene and heal all the time, but sometimes he'll do it in such a manner to give glory to his name and to reveal his power to people.
Yeah, God,
for the
God,
gospel.
God works through medicine. I mean, we pray for healing. We can, you know, God can do it through medicine as well.
Sure.
On the cutting edge of evangelism, where it's, you know, often he'll do something I think is a sign to convince people that he's God. But some things don't need a doctor to be the witness. I mean, if somebody's got cataracts in their eyes before you pray and they're gone after you pray, you know, that's something you can see with your own eyes.
Yeah, that'd be something that you just need multiple witnesses testifying to.
Right.
And that these testimonies would be credible insofar as the witnesses, to the best of our knowledge, are credible.
Yeah.
And firsthand witnesses would be better rather than second or third hand. And that they're witnessing this close to the events. So just the kind of typical things that we would do for any historical investigation.
Yes. Some things don't need a doctor to be the witness. I mean, if you've got somebody with cataracts before you pray and after you pray, they're gone. I mean, that's something you can visibly see whether you're a doctor or not. And we do have cases like that. One of the cases I could give is Brother Kato, a university president in Congo, DRC. When I was visiting with him, I just asked him if he had any miracle accounts. Said, I'm writing a book on this. He said, oh, yeah, that's interesting. He comes from a denomination that, at least in the West, didn't believe in miracles, and so he hadn't really been taught much about them, didn't believe in them today. Yet he and some of his friends in their earlier days were out doing evangelism in a village. There was a man who heard them and was convinced about the truth of the Christian message. His wife was with a witch doctor, and so he ran and got his wife. She was blind, and the witch doctor was trying to fix it. So the man brought his wife instead to them and said, your God is more powerful than these witch doctors. So you pray for my wife so she can be healed.
Mm.
And Brother Kato and his friends, they'd never done anything like that before, but they said, well, God has all power. We came for the honor of his name. Let's pray. They prayed for a couple minutes, and she starts shouting, I can see! I can see! And from then, she was in her 60s, she started dancing around. From then until her death,
wow,
a number of years later, she,
and he's an eyewitness.
She had her sight. He's an eyewitness. Let me give another example where there are a couple eyewitnesses. This is from Flint McLaughlin, who runs a business institute in connection with Cambridge University. This was an event that took place in India, where there was a man who was blind, and his eyes were clouded. flat and clouded. It looked like cataracts.
So was he completely blind?
I think he was completely blind.
Okay.
That's my understanding. And there was another witness, Robin Shields, that I contacted for verification, but although I believe Flint, but I contacted her anyway to follow up. And when they prayed for this man, he was instantly healed. He started shouting, "I can see, I can see." Mm. And for the rest of the day, he was just walking around, looking up at the trees, looking at everything, just soaking in the beauty of being able to see.
Can you imagine what that would have felt
like? Oh, God can heal psychosomatic or psychogenic ailments too, but you know, cataracts are not psychosomatic. But but getting back to your question about whether things are medically documented, you know, given all these things, you know, we don't have medical documentation in all these kinds of cases. Some of these people who were healed had probably never been to a doctor in their lives that didn't have access to that. But yes, some are documented. Dr. Rex Gardner wrote a book on this called Healing Miracles, and also an article that he published in British Medical Journal. And there are others who have written on this. Some people were able to get me medical documentation, including a doctor who reported being healed. And a team managed to test some blind and deaf people before prayer and after prayer in Mozambique. In some cases, these people were actually healed. This was published in September 2010 in the Southern Medical Journal. I also interviewed cardiologist Chauncey Crandall about a raising from the dead that he witnessed and for which he prayed.
All right, now this is going to get interesting. Raising from the dead. I remember several years ago, I had heard from the Christian philosopher J.P. Moreland. He said that, you know, he knew of raisings of the dead in other countries. And I thought, gosh, you know, had I just heard this from anyone else, I'd be very skeptical of it and just blow it off. But, you know, this is J.P. Moreland, and he just doesn't take these things lightly. But I don't know what to do with this. I mean, I can't imagine someone being raised from the dead. So what I did was I just cataloged it in my mind and said, okay, I'm just going to keep this here. I'm not going to do anything with it. And then I remember a few years ago, you said something that you were aware of people who'd been raised from the dead when you went over to the Congo and you talked to people who had raised them or witnessed it or something. And I thought, okay, well, now I do know Craig Keener. You know, this guy's a friend. I know he's a careful scholar. So now I'm really open to these things.
Yeah, it really freaked me out as well. I wasn't expecting to find quite all of that. But there are some skeptics who say, well, healings can just be psychosomatic, but nobody claims raising from the dead. Well, I'm sorry to burst their bubble on this, but people do claim that today. I don't want to give the wrong impression, because obviously the majority of people who die stay dead. That's true in Africa, just like it is anywhere else. And also, in most cases, perhaps not the one you're speaking of, but in most cases, there's no way to be sure how dead the person was, so to speak. Usually there's no medical apparatus, but in a few cases there were doctors present and they've shared with me. Chauncey Crandall, whom I just mentioned, he was called in as a cardiologist to certify it was time to pull the plug because somebody had just died of a heart attack. They had been trying for 40 minutes to revive the patient, and he was just called in to certify the obvious that it was going to be impossible at this point to revive the patient. You know, 6 minutes with no oxygen to the brain. You know, there's irreparable brain damage and so on. So he certified him dead, and he was going back to his patients in the other part of the hospital when suddenly he felt led to turn around and go back and pray for the man. And he went in and prayed for the man, and the nurse was looking at him like, "You are out of your mind." And then he turned to the other doctor, I guess, had come in with him and said, "Shock him again with the paddle." Now, as a doctor, he's going to use the medical resources available to him. But the fact is, they'd been trying to revive the man for 40 minutes. At this point, the paddle wouldn't work apart from, you know, divine intervention. The man came back to life right away. And this was, I think, just before the weekend. And he went in and there was no brain damage. You know, he goes in on Monday morning and he's talking to the guy.
Wow.
This is unusual, but it's frequent enough that, believe it or not, it came up in my random interviews with a number of people. In the Philippines, I was speaking at one seminary, and one of the staff that I worked with shared with me her testimony, although it's not her eyewitness testimony because she was the one who was dead. She just didn't have enough money. She was dying of liver cancer. This was, I think, a couple decades before. And finally, they'd taken her into the hospital, and she died. Well, at least they pronounced her dead Her abdomen, which had been bloated from the liver cancer, you know, went down to normal size.
Because she was dead.
I don't know if it was because she was dead or because of what happened afterwards, but, you know, she was in the morgue. And then at that point, there was a Baptist minister who, for some reason, wasn't sure whether they believed in healing or not, but for some reason prayed for her or prayed about her or something. And suddenly they noticed her start moving under the sheets. They pulled back the sheets thinking, you know, there was a mouse in there. Great faith, right? And she was alive.
Wow.
And she didn't believe him at first. They told her she'd been dead for an hour and 45 minutes. That was one of a number of cases. Somebody I talked with in Sri Lanka who was doing ministry there had an interpreter and told me about what happened to the interpreter. The interpreter was also a pastor, but could interpret in three languages, obviously no brain damage. This pastor died of a heart attack. He was taken to the hospital. He died there, and they were trying to revive him. In their efforts to revive him, they ended up breaking three of his ribs. Well, you know, the guy's dead anyway. You just do your best to revive him. He's not going to be needing the ribs anyway. Word had gotten around to pray for the pastor, but word hadn't gotten around that he was dead. So people were still praying. Because they didn't have the person who was supposed to pronounce the or sign the certificate to send him to the morgue, they put him off in a corner. About 24 hours later, he was still in the corner when he spontaneously came back to life and was able to describe his experience in heaven. And of course, people were amazed. And there were people from different religions there in the hospital who were listening to his testimony.
That's amazing.
And the only problem physically he had was three broken ribs. I asked a friend in Nigeria. We had done some ministry together a number of years ago when I was in Nigeria, but I hadn't been working on a book on miracles then, so I hadn't asked him anything about it before. But at this point, I asked him, "Hey, do you have any stories?" He said, "Oh yeah, I don't have a lot of them, but I have a few." One of the stories he gave me was a time when he was out doing evangelism in a certain place, and the neighbor of his host, their boy died, and so they brought the boy over and said, can you pray for him? We want to see how powerful your God is. He took the boy, he prayed for 2 or 3 hours, and the boy came back to life, and he handed them back to the host. And
wow.
They were impressed with the gospel. In Cuba, I was there in August. I interviewed, one of the people I interviewed was a nurse who I think would be able to tell the signs of death. Her own baby died, and she was just crying out to God. She didn't know what else to do at this point. She held the baby up. She cried out to God. I asked her how long she did this. She said maybe an hour and a half, and the baby came back to life. And the next day after the testimony, she brought the baby to show me.
Wow.
Yeah. Last year at SBL, I was doing a session where we were talking about how to read the healings in the, well, in my paper was partly how to read the healing narratives in the Gospel of Matthew. And I said, you know, a lot of readers in the majority world do not read these narratives the way we do in the West. They don't read them as a problem. They don't haven't bought into the anti-supernaturalism. Hua Jung, a Methodist bishop in Malaysia, says, you know, we don't have those problems you guys have in the West. We never bought into anti-supernaturalism. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, most of the majority world, we don't have a problem with that. Anyway, as I was talking about this during the question and answer session, Dr. Ayo Adewuya, who is a professor from Nigeria, is teaching in the U.S. now, a New Testament professor, he stood up and he said, my son was born dead. The midwife certified him dead. We prayed for 20 minutes. He came back to life. And he said, as far as brain damage, my son doesn't have any brain damage. He just finished his master's degree. Mm. But I'd like to give some more accounts from Congo Brazzaville. It's a small, it's not as big as Congo DRC. It's only about 3 million people or so. The people I interviewed there were in the circle of my wife's family's friends in the main evangelical denomination there, Église Évangélique du Congo, the Evangelical Church of Congo. I came across there through interviews 7 eyewitness accounts of raisings from the dead. One of them was one that I'd already heard in my family because it was the raising of my wife's sister. Now, I should mention that my wife and her mother, the eyewitness that I went to first. Neither of them are charismatic. My sister-in-law now is charismatic, but she wasn't then. She was only 2 years old. So she was 2 years old. She cried out that a snake had bitten her. And by the time the mother got to her, she wasn't breathing. There was no medical help available in this village. And so she strapped the child to her back. She didn't know what else to do. The father was out of town on business. So the mother strapped the child to her back and ran to the nearest village where a friend of theirs was an evangelist, and she wanted him to pray. Now, I asked her, how far away was this village? How long did this take? And she stopped and she thought, and she said, it was about 3 hours.
Wow.
Now, for 3 hours, as far as they could tell, Therese Magnuha, my sister-in-law, was not breathing. But she got to this other village where Koko Ngomo Moise was, and he prayed, and she started breathing. And the next day, she was fine. Mm. My sister-in-law has recently finished her master's degree. Well, I'm not gonna question my mother-in-law, but you know, for the sake of verification, right? For the sake of verification, we followed up with Ngomo Moise, who's still alive. He confirmed the story that yes, he remembered that very well. But even in the U.S., I mean, I don't have very many accounts here, but somebody in my brother's church gave me an account. The husband prayed for his wife who had died, and that was a very brief thing, but she came back. In terms of published accounts, two sociologists who were doing interviews in their studies in India, they found out cases where somebody had been, the local Hindu village elders testified, yes, this person was raised from the dead. In another case, the person had been dead long enough that worms were coming out of the person's nose. I'm not trying to explain all these. I can't verify that these people were brain dead or whatever. But as far as people could tell, they were dead, and they were cured in the context of prayer. Now, if that's a coincidence, I find it an extraordinary coincidence that coincidences coincidentally happen so often in the immediate vicinity of prayer. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a disproportionate number of cases, that's where they happen. Some things can be psychosomatic, but I think when we're talking about somebody being raised from the dead, or as far as we can tell they're dead, or babies being healed, I don't think we can explain those as psychosomatic.
So people are raised from the dead today, kind of like Lazarus or the widow's son, Jairus's daughter.
Right.
Well, I'm definitely more open to this stuff now than I was a few years back.
Yeah, me too.
It's really interesting to hear these documented cases.
This freaked me out. Even, you know, you talk about groups of people here in the U.S. that talk about miracles and stuff. I think it would freak most of them out, too, because, I mean, we just don't see things like this very often here.
Yeah, I mean, if it hadn't been for me hearing about Jesse, I would have never heard of anything happening like that in the United States. Well, what about, let's just shift the kind of miracles we're talking about here. So we've talked about something like rising from the dead, which is pretty awesome. What about nature miracles? We hear about like Jesus walking on water, how he stills the wind and the waves. I remember several years ago, before I started my doctoral work, 2000, 2001, maybe 2002, Graham Twelvetree, I was talking to him, the author of Jesus, the Miracle Worker. And he was saying some of the toughest kind of miracles to show that Jesus did were nature miracles. And he said he really wanted to see if there were any modern day accounts. He had heard of a few, but he hadn't been able to document any nature miracles like calming the sea and things like this. Tell us, what have you found?
Nature miracles, I would think it would be hard to consider those psychosomatic, but there are quite a number of accounts of nature miracles. I don't have too many of walking on water. There are reports of that in Indonesia. I'm trying to follow up with an eyewitness for that now, but there are written reports of it from some other people who said they consulted eyewitnesses, but there are quite a number of other kinds of nature miracles reported. In fact, I mentioned earlier Dr. Adewuya, who stood up in that meeting. He didn't just talk about the raising of his dead son, but he also recounted a nature miracle. But here I think maybe I'll just recount especially one. Emmanuel Atopson is my colleague in Hebrew Bible. He's from Nigeria. He grew up there as part of the Evangelical Church of West Africa. And his father was a church planter when he was a boy, when Emmanuel was a boy. And they were trying to plant a church in this one village, but he didn't have his house or his hut quite finished yet. There was no roof on it. And rainy season was starting. And the people of this village, I mean, they knew rainy season. They knew what happened when rainy season came. And a lot of people were mocking him. They were saying, you're going to get drenched. Everything in your home is going to get drenched because there's no way you can get the roof on today before the rain is coming. You know, we can see the rain is about to come. And he got angry. And he said, it's not going to rain in this village until I have a roof on this house. And it was going to take like 3 or 4 more days to get the roof on the house. Mm. So they laughed and they left. He said, oh, Lord, what have I done? He fell on his face before God. He said, people are going to dishonor your name, Lord, if it rains in this house. What have I done? But Lord, please honor your name. Don't let this happen. For the next 3 days until the roof was on that house, it rained all around the village and not a single drop of water fell in the village. At the end of those 3 days, this village, which knew rainy season, they knew it wasn't supposed to happen like this. There was only one person in the village who wasn't yet converted to Christianity. A generation later, Emmanuel tells me, people in that village still describe this event as the seminal event for the planning of the church there. Actually, while I'm on that, if you've heard of Watchman Nee, mm-hmm. Watchman Nee, I don't know, maybe in the 1920s, it was sometime early in the 20th century in the church in China. He tells a story of how he was out with an evangelism team. They were preaching in this one village. Some people were making fun and saying, for hundreds of years, it's never rained on the particular day that we hold this festival of our God. And so one of the Christians said, this year it's going to rain on that day that's coming, and you're going to see that our God is more powerful. And they laughed at him. And when he went back and told the others, Watchman and the others, they were like, oh, what have you done? You know, God's name is at stake here. You don't really want to do this unless the Lord is leading you. You know, and so they just decided they'd better pray. And they prayed and they prayed, and the day came, and that morning, you know, the sun was up, there was no sign of rain, and suddenly they heard a drop, and soon it began pouring down rain, and the festival had to be rescheduled for a little while later, another day. Mm. But this time they were bold, and they went out and said, it's going to rain on that day too. And that day, the rain poured down, it was gushing down rain as the priests were carrying the statue of this deity. They were swept in the flood, and the statue fell and broke. Lots and lots of people were converted in that village as a result of God just showing how powerful he is.
Almost like the Elijah and the prophets of Baal.
Precisely.
When you're talking about this rain, I remember an event back in the 1980s. I was a martial arts instructor. So from 1986 to 89, I had a school in Alexandria, Virginia. We worked out of Calvary Road Baptist Church. They allowed us, I was a member there, and they allowed us to use their facilities. And I trained a dozen or so people up through the black belt level. And we had an exhibition team of these skilled martial artists, and we practiced and we did these pretty cool stuff. So we would do things in nursing homes and in public schools and parks and these exhibitions. And we had permission to do them from the city of Ocean City, Maryland. We went down twice one summer. I don't recall what summer it was, but it was 1988 or 1989, one of those summers. One of the times we went down, we'd go for a couple of days at a stretch, and we'd do one in the afternoon, one or two of them in the evening, something like that. And we would give a gospel presentation after each of those exhibitions and kind of weave our stories into it. Well, on this one day, it was just raining. It rained, rain, rain all day. And later that afternoon, we were supposed to give, or maybe it was early evening, I don't recall, we were supposed to give an exhibition. It just didn't look like we were going to be able to. So they said, well, should we just stay here? And there was a church down there that allowed us to stay. And so we were just kind of staying at the church. And what should we do? So I said, well, I don't know, let's just get in the car. It doesn't look like it's raining too hard right now, so let's just get in and pray. And so we got in, we drove to the boardwalk where there was this stage, this platform where we did our exhibition. And it was still raining when we got there. So we all prayed. We just stopped. I think we were in a van, and it stopped raining. Mm-hmm. So I said, guys, all right, this is cool. Maybe God's opening up a window for us here. Let's see what we can do. So we went out there, and of course, the stage, the platform now, is just soaked. Mm-hmm. And there was a nice business. They were kind to us, and they gave us a bunch of towels, and we wiped the stage, got all the major water off of it. You know, we were going to be doing jump spinning kicks and all this kind of stuff and breaking boards. And you need a strong, firm foundation when you do that so that you don't slip and or you could really hurt yourself. Although we wiped off most of the water, it was still very slick. So we stopped at that point and we prayed that God would help dry this thing. And a wind at that moment came off the ocean and blew until the stage was dry.
Awesome.
We did our exhibition, we shared the gospel, and just as we finished up, some slight drizzles started coming down. I said, guys, let's get the stuff in the car. We packed everything up, and by the time we were putting the last thing in the van, it started pouring. Mm-hmm. So it's like, wow, this is just so cool. I mean, that is, in a sense, a nature miracle. And I'm sure a skeptic could say, well, it was just coincidence. But that was the only window all afternoon in which it was dry. It was really amazing.
Yeah, and I've seen instances like that and read reports of instances like that. But it's something that God often will do on the cutting edge of evangelism as opposed to other times. I know there was one time I was walking back from the grocery store and I said, okay, Lord, please make it stop raining. I got so drenched. but on another occasion, we were doing some campus ministry on this one campus, and we were about to have an evangelism presentation, and it had been pouring down rain all morning. And so we gathered together, we prayed. No sooner had we finished the prayer than it just became nothing more than like the dripping of a faucet, and then it cleared up. They were expecting rain all day. The sun came out. We had a nice day. But
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Your purpose, Craig, in this book is to show that there's no reason to doubt the eyewitness claims in the Gospels and Acts, or at least to say not because of the miraculous nature.
Right.
So, Craig, your purpose in this discussion is to show that there's no reason to doubt the eyewitness claims in the Gospels and Acts. We might, for other reasons, doubt it, such as, you know, maybe some might argue that there's not eyewitness testimony here, or there are corrupted accounts or something like that. Those would be different issues that we could discuss. But one thing you just can't do, I think what you're saying here is, it would be wrong to distrust the Gospels and Acts and the miraculous, the supernatural accounts in it, simply because a person doesn't see these things happening today or some sort of objection against miracles.
Right.
Okay. So what would you say to someone who says that if it's really miraculous, then it should happen all the time?
Now, the same thing I'd say to Christians who expect it to happen every time. God is sovereign. It often happens in the cutting edge of evangelism. For instance, there's a person in Mozambique. She goes into Muslim villages. Right at the beginning, she says, or often after she begins telling people about Jesus, she'll say, find somebody here in the village who's deaf, bring them here. And she'll pray. And almost always, the deaf people are healed. And then they start a church in the village the next day. Now, it should also be pointed out that for the first couple of years she was praying, it seemed like nobody was getting healed. Mm. But eventually, it began to happen regularly. But it's on the cutting edge of evangelism. Mm. And I'm delighted any time that God does it. Most of my informants who gave me testimonies of healings, they also acknowledge that God is sovereign. For example, I mentioned somebody who gave an account of a raising here in the U.S. It was wonderful that they had this raising, but they also had a son who had a deadly disease. He spent years, he eventually died from the disease. And it wasn't because they didn't pray. It wasn't because they didn't believe God. We have a lot of disappointments sometimes, and sometimes those make it hard for us to believe, because clearly God doesn't do it in every case. And it's not that God doesn't love us. My wife and I have been through a number of miscarriages. I mentioned earlier Dr. Crandall's son or Dr. Crandall, you know, he was the eyewitness of this raising. He's reported other dramatic healings that have taken place when he's prayed or seen other people pray. Actually, before all these things happened, his own son died of leukemia, and it was heartbreaking. And he just said, God doesn't always do it, but God is still God, and I'm going to believe him. Miracles are not meant as a quick fix for the world's problems. Miracles are just signs of the kingdom. They're a foretaste of the perfect future world that God has for us. They draw people's attention to what the kingdom will be like, but they're samples. God doesn't heal everything in the present. And we need to keep working in the meantime, proclaiming the good news of Christ. We need to trust God when he does and when he doesn't. We need to trust him in power and in suffering, and we need to keep working for God's kingdom.
Most people aren't healed, and we're all going to die someday.
Yes.
Even Lazarus, when he was raised from the dead,
yes,
he was raised, but he later died. So did,
yes,
the widow's son, so did Jairus' daughter. These people died. So, I mean, we're all going to die someday. That's just, according to the Bible, that is the, we have a wacky world. This
yeah,
world is in trouble because of sin.
Yeah.
The consequences of sin. Now, that's a theological thing. That's not a historical observation, of
right,
course. What we can observe is that most people aren't healed. I mean, we were praying for the healing of my father-in-law, who's a godly man, and he died of cancer, and not of, yeah, a very pleasant, so I guess no cancer is pleasant, but this, yeah, was a very unpleasant sort of cancer. So what would you say to the person who may be listening now and says, you know, I've had that kind of experience. I prayed for a loved one, and they were not healed. They died. God did not come through. So that's great. You can talk about some of these cases where they have, but my personal experience, God hasn't come through for me. I'm disappointed with him. He hasn't lived up to my expectations. What would you say to a person like that?
I would say that the purpose of miracles is not to solve all of our problems. The purpose of miracles is to point our attention to God's ultimate purpose in the kingdom of God, and to remind us of the one who brings us ultimate healing, because there's coming a day when there's going to be no more sorrow, no more pain. There's going to come a day when he's going to wipe away every tear from our eyes. And that's because there's someone who died and won't die again, because he died for us and he rose again so that we could have life, so that we could spend forever with him. And he's got a new world coming. Miracles are just a foretaste of that world. They're not that world itself. They're not all of the kingdom itself. But they let us know that there is such a kingdom. They whet our appetite for it. And I, for one, am eagerly looking forward to it.
Mm. Even so, come, Lord Jesus.
Amen.
Craig, thank you so much for the hard work that you've put into this.
Thanks so much, Mike.